For decades, stories circulated about the most haunted house in America. Those who encountered the crumbling ruins of the once magnificent mansion on the north side of Pittsburgh would never suspect the dark secrets that lingered behind the locked doors and the dark windows. The stories were rarely spoken aloud, only whispered, as if the dead might be listening. And the whispers told of bizarre murders, gruesome deaths, human experimentation, and visits to the house that inspired not only horror stories, but even a great inventor's fascination with death and the afterworld. If any home in the country deserved the moniker of America's most haunted house, it was this one. I still remember the first time I heard about this house many years ago, in 1979. It chilled me to the bone, and I never forgot it. The legend of the house on Ridge Avenue remained one of my favorite accounts of ghosts and the supernatural for decades. It haunted me so much I even dreamed about it sometimes, terrified by the images conjured up from the history of the old mansion. So turn down the lights and listen closely as we reveal one of the most horrifying stories of the entire season. It's not for the faint of heart, and if you wake up screaming tonight, don't say we didn't warn you. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Bagg. This season, we're on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crimes gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence have left lingering ghosts behind. And we're doing things a little differently this time, taking a deep dive on a legendary house that was once dubbed the most haunted house in America, and how the stories of the brutal killing, strange experiments, and bloody events that occurred within its walls took on a life of their own. Just be sure to keep listening until the end. If you listen to the podcast in hopes that we'll sometimes have twist endings, this is the episode for you. The story of the house on Ridge Avenue begins with a man named Charles Wright Congaleer, who arrived in Pittsburgh in the late 1860s. Charles was a Yankee, but he'd been living in Texas until he couldn't anymore. He'd gone south after the Civil War and made a fortune off those suffering from the broken economy of the former Confederacy, the kind of man dubbed a carpetbagger by his victims. Eventually, Charles, like so many men like him, was run out of town, and he took his money and left Texas by river steamer. He took with him his Mexican wife, Lida, and a servant girl named Essie. When the riverboat reached Pittsburgh, it docked for coal, and Charles decided the growing city looked like a good place to settle down and further grow his fortune. The three of them left the boat and checked into a luxurious hotel while Charles sought out just the right place to build a fine home for himself and his wife. Over the months while the new brick-and-mortar mansion was being constructed on a lot he'd purchased at 1129 Ridge Avenue, Charles had become a respected member of the local business community, his shameful days as a carpetbagger far behind him. Once the house was completed, it was considered one of the finest on the north side of the city. From the expansive lawn, Charles could look out the windows and see where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers met to form the Ohio. The home's back veranda, which opened off the ballroom, was where many parties and social gatherings spilled outside, offering guests and revelers that same breathtaking view. But as happy as the household looked from the outside, there were dark secrets lurking behind the closed doors. During the cold winter of 1871, Charles Congaleer began seeking warmth from someone other than his wife, the family's longtime servant, Essie. Whether she was coerced into her employer's bed or had her own reasons for being there, the two took every chance they could to slip away to the shadowy corners of the sprawling mansion for a few stolen moments together. At first, Lida was unaware of the affair, but when only three people reside in a house, it's only a matter of time before secrets are revealed. One afternoon, when Essie didn't respond to the bell she rang for her in the dining room, Lida went to the servants' quarters to look for her. After she climbed the back stairs and started down the short hallway to Essie's bedroom, she heard the unmistakable sound of heavy breathing and moaning coming from the bedroom. Knowing her husband was the only man in the house, Lida became enraged. She rushed back down the stairs to the kitchen and snapped up a meat cleaver and a large butcher's knife. Unable to hold back her anger any longer, Lida began screaming in rage as she neared Essie's room. Her cries provoked a panic in the bedroom, and while Charles and Essie were quickly dressing, Lida waited for them outside the door. When it opened, she swung the meat cleaver toward the first person who appeared. It was Charles, and the weapon slammed into his head. He fell to the floor without uttering a sound, blood pouring from the wound in his skull. Inside the room, Essie began to scream as she saw Lida pounce on her husband and begin stabbing him over and over and over again. Over the next few days, the windows of the house at 1129 Ridge Avenue remained dark. There were no lights. The doors never opened. No one came or went. A family friend called at the house, and when no one responded to his knock, he opened the door and peered inside. He called out, but there was no answer in the shadow-filled room. Where was everyone? He wondered. He took a few steps into the hall, and it was then that he heard a faint creaking noise coming from the parlor. He called out again, but once more there was no answer. He walked further into the house, following the creaking sound. As he entered the parlor, he saw Lida rocking back and forth in the corner. The wooden chair she was seated in creaked as it moved backward and forward. And the friend finally spoke. Lida, is everything all right? Lida didn't turn and look at him when he spoke. She made no reply. She just kept rocking back and forth in the chair. As the friend drew closer to her, he heard her softly crooning a lullaby, a child's nursery song, under her breath. As he realized what the song was, he noticed that Lida had something wrapped in a blanket cradled in her arms. She held it close like a baby, rocking it and singing to it. But the man knew the Congoliers had no children. He spoke to Lida again, his voice a whisper, but still, she didn't respond. She stared straight ahead, her eyes glazed over. He carefully leaned down and gently took the bundle from her arms. He carefully opened the blanket and then recoiled in horror. The bundle, which was soaked with blood, fell to the floor. As it hit the wooden floorboards with a thud, the blanket fell away and the object it had been wrapped around rolled toward him. He tried to scream as he realized the bloody object at his feet was the servant girl Essie's severed head. The brutal double murder shocked the city, and for the next two decades, the house on Ridge Avenue remained empty. Locals avoided it, and few dared to trespass on the grounds. Neighborhood children, though, would sometimes throw rocks at the windows and jump rope on the sidewalk in front, singing rhymes about Lida and her bloody meat axe. In the two decades that passed, the north side neighborhood around Ridge Avenue faded and became worn down and seedy. Many of the big old houses there were abandoned or torn down or cut up and divided into apartments. This became the fate of the mansion at number 1129. In 1892, the house became an apartment building, rented cheaply to railroad workers and their families, but most refused to stay in the place for long. They complained about hearing screams and the sobbing of a woman that came from empty rooms and darkened hallways. Some also spoke of the ominous sounds of a rocking chair creaking in the darkness and a woman's voice that mumbled lullabies and nursery rhymes. Families moved in and out over the next 2 years, and then the house was abandoned again. This time, it remained vacant until 1901, when it was purchased by German immigrant Dr. Adolf C. Brunreichter. The doctor became something of a mystery to longtime residents of the neighborhood. Although he'd been warned of the house's unusual history, he dismissed the stories and, after he moved in, was rarely seen by those who lived nearby. He kept to himself, and when he was spotted outside the house, he never spoke, waved, smiled, or did anything else to acknowledge his neighbors. While most forgot about the doctor, there were some neighbors who held their breath and waited for something terrible to happen at 1129 Ridge Avenue. They didn't have to wait for long. During the early morning hours of August 12, 1901, the family who lived next door heard a blood-curdling scream shatter the stillness of the neighborhood. When they ran outside to see what was happening, they realized the screams were coming from number 1129. Just as the father started to open the gate to Dr. Brunreichter's house, the family was stunned by a bright red flash that illuminated all the windows in the mansion. It was followed by a booming crack that shattered the glass in all the windows and sent shockwaves across the lawn. The ground trembled, cracking the sidewalks and breaking windows in surrounding homes. The smell of ozone was in the air. Neighbors quickly picked up their telephones and urged the operators to connect them to the police and fire departments. By the time the authorities had arrived, a crowd had gathered in front of Brunreichter's house. It was assumed the doctor was still inside, possibly dead or injured. No one had seen him leave, but no one was brave enough to go inside and look for him. Finally, a crew of firefighters entered the house to search for Brunreichter. There was no sign of him. But what they did find sent those brave men running back out into the street. In one of the basement rooms, the police who entered the house next found the gut-wrenching scene that had forced the firemen to flee. It was a woman, naked and tied spread-eagled on a bed. Her head was missing. It was later found in a makeshift laboratory that the doctor had set up in another room. From what investigators could determine, Brunreichter had been experimenting with severed heads. Using electrical equipment, he had been trying to keep them alive after decapitation. It looked as though one of his devices had created the explosion that was witnessed by the neighbors. It had apparently been the screams of the young woman tied to the bed that had awakened them. She had not been the doctor's only victim, though. In another part of the basement, officers discovered the graves of five other women. All their heads had been severed from their necks. It was assumed they had been the subjects of earlier experiments. As for Dr. Brunreichter, there was no sign of him in the house. He'd escaped during the confusion that followed the explosion and vanished. A search was started, but it didn't last long. No clues were found. The mad doctor had disappeared without leaving a trace. Or had he? In September 1927, an old man was arrested in New York's Bowery District. He'd been living on the street, sleeping under bridges and in alleys. He was one of the legions of the homeless in the city, but was arrested one night for public drunkenness. At the station house, the man stood his turn, waiting to be booked with other dirty and disheveled men, but officers would later say they had a bad feeling about him. As the line shuffled along, desk officers entered their names in the record one at a time. When the old man reached the front of the line, he was asked for his name, and the man croaked a reply with a harsh German accent. "My name is Adolf Brunreichter," he said. And soon he began telling stories to the officers at the police station that even the most hardened among them would never forget. Brunreichter said he had once been an eminent physician who had worked diligently to prolong life. Unfortunately, he could only succeed with his experiments by ending the lives of certain test subjects. He told of how many years earlier he'd bought a house in Pittsburgh to which he enticed young women as guests. Anticipating romance, the women were instead beheaded and then used in experiments to keep their severed heads alive. Brunreichter spoke of rape, torture, and murder, and then offered the locations of graves for other women who were not discovered in the cellar of the house. Brunreichter spent the next month behind bars, but investigators had trouble proving his stories. He was frequently visited by newspaper reporters who dubbed him the Pittsburgh Spook Man, but the district attorney was never able to discover any evidence to charge him in New York. Eventually, he was released and quickly disappeared. When officers checked his cell, they would find words scrawled on the brick wall, written in Brunreichter's own blood. He'd written just six words: "What Satan hath wrought, let man beware." That was all he'd left behind. The man who claimed to be Dr. Adolf Brunreichter was never heard from again. But by 1927, when the mad doctor allegedly appeared and disappeared again, the house on Ridge Avenue had claimed other lives. After the discovery of Dr. Brunreichter's laboratory, the house was abandoned again. It stood empty for years, its reputation growing with each passing month. Those with an interest in psychic phenomena visited the place and, when interviewed afterwards, spoke of a, quote, fearsome presence inhabiting the place. Word spread that Charles Congalier had built the house on an ancient Native American burial ground, which they suggested meant the house had been doomed from the start. In 1915, a spiritualist medium named Julia Murray came to the house with a group of her followers. She stated that a horrible spirit was attached to number 1129, and witnesses claim that while she was there, quote, objects hurled by unseen hands barely missed striking her. Before she fled the house, Julia predicted that the entity in the house would kill again and would eventually reach out beyond the confines of the physical house. 5 years later, in 1920, the stories about the house on Ridge Avenue got the attention of one of America's greatest inventors, Thomas Edison. In addition to his many other inventions, Edison was fascinated with the idea that a device could be built that could communicate with the dead. Edison was a self-taught genius who began experimenting with scientific theories as a child. Throughout his life, he maintained that it was possible to build anything if the right components were used, including a sort of radio that could communicate with the other side. Now, Edison never claimed any interests in ghosts or spiritualism. He was an agnostic who followed no religious teachings, but he did believe that when a person died, their body decayed, but the intelligence they had lived on. His theory that what many called the spirit world was simply a limbo filled with disembodied intelligence. He theorized that a machine could be built that tapped into this limbo, or so he announced to newspapers after his visit to the house on Ridge Avenue. No one knows what happened while he was at the house, but whatever it was, it inspired him to start trying to figure out how such a machine could be built. Well, Edison soon began working on the apparatus. A friend of the inventor, the famous magician Joseph Dunninger, later claimed he was shown a prototype of the machine, but few others would claim they saw it, even though Edison allegedly continued working on it until his death in October 1931. A few years after that visit, by the middle 1920s, there were many who still recalled Julia Murray's premonitions about the evil that was connected to the house on Ridge Avenue. This probably started some rumors to spread when people moved into the old mansion after it was turned into cheap housing for non-union workers. It was during this time that the Equitable Gas Company, located just a few blocks away, built a huge natural gas storage complex. As the project was nearing completion, union workers went on strike and were replaced by Italian immigrants who were willing to cross the picket line. Several vacant homes in the neighborhood were converted into apartments, including number 1129. Soon after moving in, though, the Italians realized that something was not right in the house. Their fears were dismissed and their complaints were brushed off by supervisors at the gas company. There were no ghosts in the house, they told them. It was simply the union workers trying to scare them away. Well, after that, the Italians did their best to ignore what was happening or just laugh things off as practical jokes, no matter how frightening they might be. But then one night, it all became too much to ignore. One evening, there were 14 of the workers seated around a table in the common dining room. They just finished supper and were now laughing and talking over glasses of homemade wine. One of the men got up and carried a stack of dirty dishes into the kitchen, hurling good-natured insults at those who weren't helping him. One of those who jokingly replied to the ribbing was the man's brother. The conversation continued for several minutes before he realized his brother hadn't returned from the kitchen. He followed him into the kitchen and found the door to the basement standing open. Moments later, the festive mood in the dining room was cut short by a chilling scream. Rushing into the kitchen, they found the room empty. But then they saw the basement door was open. One of the men grabbed a light, and several of them crowded together and started down the steps. But before they could reach the bottom, they froze, eyes locked on the macabre scene ahead of them. In the dim light, they saw one of the brothers now hanging from an overhead beam. On the floor, directly under his feet, was his brother. He was lying face down in a spreading pool of blood. A splintered board had been driven through his chest and exited from his back. As the men struggled to understand what they were seeing, all of them later reported they were suddenly slammed backward by some sort of strong but invisible force. This was followed by the sound of heavy footsteps below them on the stairs, pounding in their direction. In a panic, the men turned and ran back up the steps. As they tripped over one another into the kitchen, the door behind them slammed shut, which was then followed by the sounds of other doors slamming throughout the house. Too terrified to stay there, they ran to another apartment on Ridge Avenue where other workers were living and called the police. When officers arrived, they attributed the deaths of the two brothers to a bizarre accident. The first man, they explained, had tripped on a loose step going down the stairs and had fallen, impaling himself on a board that had been left propped up against the steps for some reason. His brother had died because of the same loose step, except that his head had somehow gotten tangled in some electrical wires that were hanging above the staircase, which strangled him. But the Italians didn't believe it. They knew there was something evil in the house, and they quickly moved out, wanting nothing more to do with number 1129. Part of Julia Murray's prediction, folks said, had come true. They had no idea what would happen next, but didn't she say that the presence in the house was hoping to reach out beyond the wood and brick of its walls? On Monday, November 14, 1927, a crew of 16 workmen climbed to the top of the Equitable Gas Company's huge 5 million cubic foot natural gas storage tank to find and repair a small leak. There was nothing ordinary about the job. Leaks sometimes occurred, and there wasn't anything strange about them. Until this day. At 11:43 a.m., a great sheet of flame erupted from the tank and the massive steel container lifted into the air with the force of the explosion. Steel, stone, brick, and wood went hurling into the sky. Two of the men who'd been on top of the tank were thrown against a brick building more than 100 feet away, their silhouettes there outlined in blood. Moments later, a second tank exploded, creating another gigantic ball of fire. Then a third tank, this one only partially full, was wrenched apart and the gas inside added to the inferno. The smoke and flames were visible for miles. The force of the blast was so strong that it blew out windows, shook buildings on their foundations, knocked trains off tracks, and damaged homes and businesses within a 20-mile radius. Daniel Jones, Battalion Chief of Engine Company No. 47, was in command of the first fire unit to arrive on the scene. He described it as a holocaust with great waves of black smoke filling the air. Witnesses later spoke of houses collapsing, chimneys falling over, brick, broken glass, twisted pieces of metal, and other debris falling on the heads of shaken residents who rushed into the streets from their wrecked homes, believing the city had been hit by an earthquake. Dozens of rescue workers were injured when weakened structures fell on top of them. Neighborhoods were flooded by broken water mains. Fires spread and large sections of the city were leveled and reduced to ruins. Later, sections of the huge gas storage tanks were found more than 1,000 feet away from where they had been standing. The people of Pittsburgh had never seen anything like this before. The following day, rough estimates stated that at least 28 people had been killed by the explosion and at least 600 had been injured. Rescue crews dynamited the ruins and searched for the bodies of dozens of others who were still missing. Thousands were left homeless by the destruction. In most cases, only mounds of rubble and debris marked the spots where nearby buildings once stood. At one place, though, not even brick and stones remained. At 1129 Ridge Avenue, two blocks from the site of the explosion, there was nothing left but a smoldering crater. Although homes on both sides and across the street from where number 1129 had stood were heavily damaged, they were still standing. Yet where the most haunted house in America had stood, there was nothing. A hole that was found to be 85 feet deep was all that was left. It was the only house in the neighborhood for which no trace could be found. Today, the Carnegie Science Center occupies the side of the Equitable Gas Company tanks, and that explosion is just a distant memory of a tragedy from the past. The spot where 1129 Ridge Avenue once stood is the interchange of Route 65 and Interstate 279. Nothing from the days of the Congoliers, Dr. Brunreichter, or any of the other unlucky occupants of the house still lingers. Or does it? If it's possible for the spirits of the dead to wander restlessly along a busy highway, then surely this would be a place where such spirits would dwell, the place where one of the most evil houses in America could once be found. It's a spooky ending, right? I mean, honestly, it's a spooky story, the whole thing. But there's just one small problem with it. Even though it's appeared in countless books, magazines, movies, and even TV shows over the years, the story of the house on Ridge Avenue is completely untrue. I guess I should say before I tell you that it's all untrue, there really was a house that once stood at 1129 Ridge Avenue in Pittsburgh, and there really was an explosion that took place at the Equitable Gas Company in 1927. In fact, the explosion is the reason why death came calling at number 1129. Not for Charles Congolier, his maid Essie, the victims of Dr. Brunreichter, or for those two Italian brothers, but for a woman named Mary. Her death was a freak accident. When the gas tanks exploded, the window in her laundry room shattered and she was struck by flying glass. She was only 29 years old, and her death was made even more tragic by the fact that she left five young children behind. But it would be Mary's bizarre death, and more importantly, her family's long and shadowy history with Pittsburgh's organized crime rackets that helped spawn the sensational legends of gruesome murders, medical experiments, spirit telephones, and a very haunted house. It was a story that was so terrifying to tell over and over again that it seemed almost too good to be true, because it was. But before we get to Mary and what really happened at number 1129, let's take a look at what didn't. Like a lot of really good legends, the story of the house on Ridge Avenue is a clever blending of fact and fiction, although it's definitely a lot more fiction than anything else. The house was not built by Charles Congolier. In fact, he never existed, so he wasn't married, didn't make a fortune in Texas, didn't have an affair with his maid, and wasn't murdered in the house. It turns out that even the name Congolier is wrong. It's a misspelling of the name Consigliere from a newspaper article written after the gas explosion, but we'll come back to that. I should also probably mention that the real house at 1129 Ridge Avenue was not a mansion. It was a working-class home, built in the 1880s. The style was a standard Manchester row house. Look that up if you want to see what those kinds of houses look like. It was never lived in by railroad workers or non-union gas company workers, nor was it ever owned by Dr. Adolf Brunreichter, who, like Charles Congolier, never existed. The only mention of his name anywhere in American crime history is his connection to this house, the fictional connection. Now, that would be pretty odd if he was real, since his crimes were more than lurid and sensational enough to have gained the attention of reporters and crime writers. But when I first started really digging into his story in 2003, I couldn't find him anywhere. I even checked with other crime researchers, but they had nothing. I checked newspaper and library archives in Pennsylvania and New York, where he'd allegedly been written about as the Pittsburgh Spook Man, but there was nothing there either. In addition, there wasn't a single death record, real estate transaction, or police report involving anyone named Brunreichter connected to the house on Ridge Avenue or anywhere else in Pittsburgh. The mysterious Dr. Brunreichter had vanished so easily because he never actually ever existed. And neither did Julia Murray, the spirit medium who allegedly made the dire predictions and pronouncements about the evil in the house. Thomas Edison, of course, did exist, but there's no record of him ever visiting number 1129. If he had, he would have shown up at the front door of a family who would have certainly remembered his visit. As for Edison expressing his interest in a machine that could communicate with the dead, well, that much is true. But it wasn't inspired by the Ridge Avenue house. And it's not even clear if Edison ever finished the machine before his death. Despite numerous searches by his staff, no prototypes or plans for the machine have ever been found. One part of the legend that is also true is the horrific story of the explosion at the nearby Equitable Gas Company tanks on November 14, 1927. Dozens were killed and injured, and the explosions did destroy a large part of the surrounding area, but the house at 1129 Ridge Avenue was not one of those destroyed. No gaping crater was left at the site, suggesting the house had been sucked down into hell or something. In truth, it suffered only minor damage. Several windows were broken. The house remained standing for years after the explosion and was only eventually torn down to make way for the interstate and redevelopment in the area. But even though the ghost story about the house wasn't true, the house at number 1129 did become a place of sorrow for one family in 1927, when the life of a young mother named Mary Consigliere was ended by a few pieces of flying glass. The Consigliere family didn't arrive in Pittsburgh after the Civil War like Charles Consigliere was said to have done in the legend. Mary and her husband, Giacomo, who went by the name Jack, had been living in the coal towns of southwest Pennsylvania, where he worked as a miner. Immigration and census records, marriage licenses, and land records tell the story of their time in the region during the first two decades of the 20th century. Jack came to America with his extended family from Villa Rosa, a town in Sicily. Mary also came from Sicily, and she had immigrated with her father around the same time. Jack was 9 years older than she was when they married in 1913. The house that Jack bought in 1923 was hardly a mansion. It was a narrow, eight-room, two-and-a-half-story brick row house at the corner of Ridge Avenue and Sproat Alley. The five-house row had been constructed in 1886 by John Jacob Lawrence, a Civil War veteran and paint company owner who'd bought the property in the 1880s from the Allegheny Gas Works Company. The Gas Works had bought the land in 1859, but never used it to develop as part of their riverfront plant. Up until the early 1920s, the houses had been rented out, and while most of the tenants' names have been forgotten, there was one that did enjoy some minor notoriety in the city. In the 1890s, Nicholas Didier and his wife Ida Joy lived at 140 Ridge Avenue, which was, by the way, renumbered and became number 1129 when Pittsburgh annexed Allegheny City in 1907. Anyway, Nicholas was a foundry manager, but Ida Joy became well-known as a portrait artist. Nicholas died in the house in 1895, and he was only 39. The property changed hands several times over the next 25 years until Jack Consigliere bought it in 1923. It was that same year that Pittsburgh newspapers first published reports of Jack being arrested for bootlegging. Soon after moving into 1129 Ridge Avenue, Jack put the property into Mary's name, a common organized crime tactic used to protect personal property from seizure by law enforcement. 4 years later, in January 1927, Jack, or Mary if you just go by the name on the land title, bought a three-story building at 106 East General Robinson Street. That property became the Rosa Villa Restaurant. For the next 30 years, both 1129 Ridge Avenue and the Rosa Villa were prominently mentioned in news articles, all of them about violence, arrests, and criminal charges filed against Jack and members of his extended family. Most of the arrests were for bootlegging and gambling, but they became notorious usual suspects when rival mobsters were beaten, kidnapped, or killed. Local and federal law enforcement officials had extensive files on the Consigliers. They just weren't able to make the charges stick. But even the general public was well aware that the Rosa Villa was a popular mob hangout. Violence and rumors hung over multiple generations of the family for much of the 20th century. After the gas explosion that resulted in Mary's death, her body was prepared for burial at the nearby Page Street home of Santo LaQuatra, a relative of Jack's and the man who sold him the Rosa Villa property. 5 years after Mary died, the house on Page Street was dynamited during an organized crime turf war that caused bombings and murders throughout the city. The Roosevelt itself was later bombed in 1958, a target in another series of murders and bombings the authorities called a racket war. The 1927 gas explosion and rumors about one of Pittsburgh's best-known mob families created the perfect excuse for locals to spin wild stories about the house at 1129 Ridge Avenue. Somehow, those stories grew over time, mixing in more horrific elements as days went by. It was in the late 1970s when the stories first started appearing in print, first in newspapers and then in books, with each writer simply regurgitating and then adding to the stories they'd read before. Later, the stories crept onto the internet, and the site where the house once stood became a spot where ghost enthusiasts gathered and wished they'd had a chance to visit the place that legend claimed was the most haunted house in America. Well, truth, they say, is stranger than fiction. Usually that's the case, but not always. When it comes to the story of the house on Ridge Avenue, fiction was certainly much stranger than the truth. The house probably wasn't haunted, but we'll never know for sure since it was demolished in the late 60s. But the story appealed to the imaginations of so many people in Pittsburgh that it became one of the city's most enduring legends. The explosion, organized crime, all of it mixed up together, created the perfect conditions for the creation of frightening tales. Tales that deflected attention away from the real-life horror of murder, violence, and crime. There's more show to come, so stay tuned after these informative messages from our sponsors.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 15 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode at a delightful little Italian restaurant in Pittsburgh. It was edited and produced by my co-host, Cody Beck, who is not here with us today. So, first of all, let me apologize for us getting this episode to you a little bit late. Let me secondarily apologize to you the fact that Cody wasn't able to be with us today. This is literally being finished up on the day that you hear it. Cody has had some a death in the family and got some serious things going on with another family member right now. And we couldn't, I just couldn't justify pulling him away to work on the podcast when things aren't good. So please have a good thought for Cody today and in the weeks to come. There's been a lot of rough stuff going on. So anyway, we're going to plow ahead with the podcast, though, with just me. So that's my third apology. It's just me. So what this sounds like, I will have no idea, probably. So I'm just going to hope for the best and hope you guys will be understanding with us as this moves forward. So I do want to mention we do have a lot of great events coming up this fall. I've just skipped past anything to do with summer. I'm tired of it. I don't know about you guys, but I think I'm done with it now. And it is like in the 90s and almost 100 again, which I, you know, did not foresee us going back to before the end of the year. But here we are. But as I always tell Cody, the world is on fire. So there we are. So we've got tours, dinners, all kinds of stuff. But one thing you got to remember, I've had people already asking me if we'll reopen stuff that's sold out. We can't do it. It's a limited number of seats for almost every event. Every once in a while, we'll have a tour we can open something up on, but not very often, but sometimes. But just remember, tickets are sold on a first-come, first-served basis, so you don't want to miss out. I mean, we've got tours in Alton and Springfield, Decatur and Chicago this fall. They all have their own websites for tickets. But for events and tours with me, some of the dinner events I do at the American Oddities Museum and that kind of thing, you can find all those at dinnerandspirits.com. And you can also catch up with me sometimes this fall at the American Oddities Museum. That's in the Mineral Springs, which I know you've heard us talk about when from our very first season of the podcast and with the Return to Alton episodes that we did last year. You find it at the Mineral Springs in Alton, Illinois. So if you're in town, stop by. We're just like, 25, 30 minutes from downtown St. Louis, near the interstates. If you happen to be passing through, jet on over to Alton. It's not a big sidetrack, and it doesn't only cost, so it's only $5 to come through. So we're open every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from noon to 5. So hopefully we will get a chance to see some of you guys coming up. So I know we've had some new people who have subscribed to our Patreon sponsorship for American Hauntings through Patreon. Cody has that list, so we'll catch up with all of you to give you your shout out in an upcoming episode. But if you are interested in Patreon, we have 3 full seasons of that alternate podcast that you can binge, and we're now pretty deep into season 4, getting toward the end, actually. And those shows are posted every other week, so that means if you like the podcast, you can get a new show every single week with no waiting, and that's at patreon.com, American Hauntings. So I don't have listener reviews. I got a couple of text messages that I'll get to here in just a few minutes, but I wanted to talk just a little bit about this episode. This was one I was kind of hoping that I would be able to bounce a little bit off Cody with because of the nature of the episode. I as I maybe explained a little in the reading and the script that I did for it, I got fascinated with this show back, it was in the late 70s for sure. I want to say like 79, maybe something like that. But I had picked up a book, which I think a lot of you who've been listening to the show for a while have heard me talk about. It was called Haunted Houses, and it was by Richard Weiner and Nancy Osborne. And they, now I think it might have been in their second book. Well, regardless, I ran across the book and had read the book and got fascinated with the story. And so the first half of the story that I did, I kind of based it on everything that I had read in his book and some other things that I picked up along the way about this particular house. And I confess, I was completely sucked in by this thing. I really thought this is the creepiest, scariest story I've ever heard. And, it just had all these perfect elements. It makes a great horror story. It would make a great movie. It was all the stuff about it that it just fascinated me. And, I was kind of downhearted when I found out in the early 2000s that, the story wasn't true. And I had gotten an email, and as it turns out, now doing a little sleuthing, it turns out that the email I got wasn't accurate either, but it did get me started looking more into the history of the house. I had gotten an email from a guy who told me his name was Robert Congalier. Well, as you know, that name didn't exist. It was a misspelling for the real family who had lived at that address, the Concilier family who'd lived there. And it obviously there was somebody pulling my leg, but they had apparently found out at least some of the information about it, because it turned out that, there had only been one death in the house ever, and that it was never a mansion, and that it had been standing for quite a long time, long after it supposedly blew up and was sucked down into the pit of hell, this story of it sort of ends. But he did tell me about Mary and her dying because she was cut by glass and bled to death. So that's what got me started digging into this story. And, we had limited resources back in the early 2000s. There wasn't a lot that you could really delve into, not very easily, not from halfway across the country anyway. I shouldn't say Pittsburgh is halfway across the country from Illinois, but it's some distance. And it was a little hard to dig into at first, but the more I did, the more I kept finding that things weren't quite right. And then as I continued on from there, I found a lot more of it was really, really not right. And so that kind of got me started on digging into everything that actually did take place connected to this house, you know, and you've got, you got mafia people, organized crime in Pittsburgh. You had this family, you know, who had been living and associated with this house and the restaurant around the corner kind of thing, and the bombings and the attempted assassinations and all that. It really tells a fascinating story, except the one thing that bothers me a bit about this story is how it went from, you know, being people talking about, you know, organized crime and its connection to this house and how it got spun into what it was. That to me, you know, and I sort of hinted at the idea that these kinds of scary stories were probably better than, you know, at least in most people's minds, it's better than what they've been dealing with in regards to this house. You know, they were looking at, you know, organized crime and the murders and things that went along with it. But, you know, somebody felt the need to create this whole story. And I don't know, it seems hard to make that leap between the two to me. I mean, I don't know. I no expertise on that, but it just seems tough. So I don't know how that happened, but somewhere along the line it did. I don't know if it was convenient because you had an address that was notorious. So why not make it more notorious? I mean, I got how it continued to grow because that happens a lot. And we've talked about that a lot in past episodes of the show, is once you get started with stories, people feel like adding on their own bits and pieces to it. And I know that that's a lot of what happened with Dr. Brunreichter and all that kind of stuff. It was all things that were embellished to make the story scarier, you know, just like it being destroyed and only a crater left in its place and that kind of thing. So these are the kinds of things that I'm always fascinated with, but I just, that's a tough leap for me to figure out as to how it went from one to the other the way that it did. But apparently it did, because nothing that is, according to the legend, happened at this house actually happened there. And there's no trace of any of the people who supposedly live there. They just don't exist, at least in the imaginary side of the story. So, truth is stranger than fiction, but not this time. Definitely the fiction is much stranger than the fact. The truth behind the story is a lot easier for us to wrap our heads around, I think, than most of the stories that were associated with it before. So anyway, that's where we are with that. I wish I had some of Cody's questions thrown at me with this episode, but if you guys have any, feel free to text them to me and we can get into this a little deeper if there's some discussion to be had in a future episode. Hopefully, I feel like I told as much of the story as I could. And hopefully it all starts to kind of make sense to you. So if you hear this story, you're going to know that, and you know, it's not as wide reaching as something like the Myrtles or something, obviously, but it's a story that has been out there for a while. And I still run across it on a regular basis being told very wrong. But I had written about it, I guess like 2003, I published the first article about it being not haunted in the way that it's supposed to have been. So, I mean, that's been more than 20 years ago. So, but you still find the skewed version of the story out there somewhere. So if you do happen to run across it or hear it, you're going to know that there really are facts behind the story, that it's not all just crazy stuff like that. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the episode. And like I said, if you've got any questions, please let me know. And I am more than happy to try and answer them for you. So I'm going to take you on to, our last parts about the show. I don't have the ghostwriter stuff. Cody would have it. But if you do have a comment or a question about the show, you can email Cody at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Or you can text us here on the Haunt Line, which is 217-791-7859. And it might get read on the show or it might just get answered right away. But regardless, you can text us on that line. And I've got a couple of them today. One's a little short. The other one is actually not a real long message, but my answer is a little long. So you'll be glad we only have two of them, I think. So here I've got, let's see. Okay, so here we go. This is from the 516, and it's from Steph in the 516, and it says, "Hey, extra creepy points. I was listening to the Taliesin episode yesterday on August 15th when I realized it was the anniversary of the murders," and then she put Shudder. "I know you usually time the release dates this way when you can do so." Yeah, I do when I can. when I can do it, I try to keep them kind of close. I mean, it's not Sometimes it just works out that way. Other times it doesn't, but I like to if I can. It's kind of fun that way. And then the second part of her message says, I'm a longtime listener, but I chose to skip season 3 because of the content and specifically because I found the movie The Strangers and anything like it so fucking disturbing. I'm finally listening to episode 1 and you all talk about The Strangers in the discussion, so now I feel validated. Yeah, I could kind of understand that. I get it. That is one of those things. And that's one of those movies that, you know, I think we talked about, I know we've talked about before, and boy, she's in for a big surprise when she gets to the Keddy murders episode. But it's one of those things that the movie's so scary because it seems like it could be real. You know, it seems so realistic, which obviously it was based on a true story. So you kind of get it. So if that kind of thing freaks you out, then you may not want to listen to that episode. So then I got the last message here from Jim and the 331, and it says, Troy and Cody, since you guys are into movies, I thought I would ask your opinion about this. I love Veronica Lake movies. I just love Veronica Lake. Anyway, I own a lot of them. One I'm debating on seeing is her last movie, Flesh Feast, a movie about cloning Hitler. That sounds bad. Okay, we'll get to that. Have either of you two watched it? And if so, is it worth seeing or is it as bad as it sounds? Seeing it's a horror movie, I thought that's one you might have seen. Love the podcast. One of these days, my wife and I will do a tour. Well, Jim, I could tell you that just because it sounds bad, in this case, it is. It's absolutely, absolutely horrible. And to just give you a little bit, I found a little review of it that I thought you might enjoy that I wanted to read for you. It'll tell you everything you need to know about this movie and why it got made and why Veronica is in it. So the review goes, in the 1940s, Veronica Lake made a meteoric rise in film stardom. Thanks to her sultry beauty and her highly exploited peekaboo hairstyle. And if you don't know what that means, just Google a picture of her because she was a knockout. But she always wore her hair kind of draped over one eye. She starred opposite big names like Alan Ladd and Frederick March, scoring screen successes in films like This Gun for Hire and I Married a Witch. She's held her own with female stars as well, and she surprised even her detractors with her performance as a bitter Navy nurse in So Proudly We Hail. But changing times and her own failings caught up with her, and by the end of the decade, her heyday was over. With two unsuccessful marriages behind her and two more in the future, Veronica headed for New York, where she made occasional television and summer stock appearances before dropping completely out of sight. It was briefly big news when she was found working as a barmaid in a second-rate hotel in the early 60s, but by now her longtime alcoholism and years of hard living had robbed her of her looks. Without them, public interest in her soon faded again. She did return to the stage in assorted vehicles, but her success was minimal. Eventually, she relocated to Miami, Florida, where she lived in relative obscurity. In 1966, she went to Canada for a part in an obscure movie called Footsteps in the Snow, which had no U.S. release. The following year, she was discovered by some industrial filmmakers who had long wanted to present a commercial feature. They announced her to star in their film, Time is Terror, and convinced her to invest in the project. But as one author put it, if ever a movie queen suffered a terminal comedown, this was it. Surrounded by amateur performers and pathetic production values, she failed even to rise to a minimum level in this Miami, Florida shot quickie. Looking utterly ordinary in long shots and luridly aged in close-ups, poor Veronica didn't act so much as walk through her part. So this is, by the way, you're talking about an earlier movie, as a deranged doctor who's hit upon a successful youth restoration formula using flesh feasting maggots, she looks both bored and confused. Her best moments come when she's forced to ad-lib while she struggles desperately to don a pair of rubber gloves. Supporting cast is no help at all, merely advancing the plot by talking it to death. Director Brad Ginter, good grief, apparently only required the actors to move while the camera was pointing at them, so their fault isn't entirely theirs. As for the twist ending involving an attempt to put a supposedly long dictator back in power, forget it, just like the script does. There's admittedly one intentionally hilarious scene involving a private detective and a nurse and a corpse in a wheelchair that predates Weekend at Bernie's. But there's a whole lot of nothing there. Anyway, the just to sum this up, the film got shelved for 3 years because they had never finished it with the master shots. Then in 1970, the production company scraped it together, changed the title to Flesh Feast, and released it to cash in on Lake's just-published biography. Because leading ladies like Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, and Olivia de Havilland had unexpectedly revived their careers in horror movies, this travesty was promoted as Veronica's comeback film. This was a strange course of action for filmmakers to pursue, though, because it's unlikely the audience for a horror movie of this quality either knew or cared who Veronica Lake was. As expected, it did nothing for her career, and she died in poverty 3 years later. A previous reviewer cites a scene in which a female detective working undercover as a nurse in the doctor's laboratory enlists the help of a multi-talented chauffeur to cut up the body parts. Poor Mrs. Lustig, she sighs. I hope she doesn't mind leaving her body to science. Try not to think about it, advises the chauffeur, sawing away. I guess you're right, Hans, concludes the detective nurse. What's done is done. Alas, the unintentional humor is the only remotely entertaining part of this tripe. What a sad end to a career of a still fondly remembered star. So I think that probably tells you everything and a lot more you need to know about that particular movie. If you want to watch it, you can watch it at least, for that reason. There really isn't any other to watch it. It's sad that that happened. I mean, with some people like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, they put out, What Happened to Baby Jane, which is considered a classic. This, however, was not. But I also think about right around the same time, Basil Rathbone, his last film. Now, Basil Rathbone being the guy that you would recognize immediately, even if you didn't know his name, because he played Sherlock Holmes, and that's a version of Sherlock Holmes that most people recognize. But he also was in things like, Robin Hood and the Mark of Zorro. He had done hundreds of quality films. But the very last film he ever did was called Hillbillies in a Haunted House. And I think that, again, is all you need to know just from the title of how bad this thing was. And so it's sad that that happened to a lot of people back from the glory days of Hollywood. So anyway, if you have any texts that you'd like to send us, again, the number is 217-791-7859. And I think we're going to wrap this show up. I'm sure to many of you, not a second too soon. Anyway, thanks for listening. Share the show with your friends, neighbors, anyone you know. If you like the show, or even if you don't, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes anyway, or just comment and engage everyone in our feed. Anyway, send an email and drop us a text on the haunt line at 217-791-7859. You can also check out us out on our social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, and occasionally Twitter. And also don't forget, use the discount code podcast when shopping for books, tours, events, whatever, at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, American Hauntings Clothing. And you can use that same code there too. Just use the code podcast, get 10% off everything you order. This episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor and is produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. I'm not Cody, but I'm reading his part. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes. that's good. Show notes, links, and sometimes photos that go along with each episode. Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and we definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye. So long, and see you later. Well, welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 15 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode at a